Hey, welcome to Your Turn. This is Mike talking. Delighted to have you with us. And this is the day after a what many people say is a historic midterm election. For one thing, more money was spent on this one, I think, than any midterm election in history. And it may have even rivaled the elections of 2 years ago, the presidential. But a lot of money was spent, thanks to the Supreme Court, thanks to corporations, thanks to unions pumping money in. And I guess the Tea Party movement also energized a lot of people. And my guest today is Bill Bransford. He is the general counsel for the Senior Executives Association. Bill is up on Capitol Hill literally all the time. He probably knows what's going on in Congress as far as federal workers are concerned, as well as anybody in town. We've had union representatives on the show in the past, and we've invited some who haven't come yet, but we wanted to make it clear that we're trying to get all viewpoints here. But I thought Bill would be about the best person around to give us an assessment of what happened yesterday in the midterm election. Bill, one of the interesting things we were talking before the show, as you were saying, the big winners here are the pollsters.
The pollsters. They called this one. This has been anticipated for quite some time, and I will tell you that the Democratic staffers who I've worked closely with over the past 4 years have all been scrambling the last 3 or 4 months looking for their next employment. So they believed it, and it turned out to be pretty much right, exactly according to prediction. So I have to give credit to the pollsters. I was watching one TV channel last night that was trying to give hope to Democrats by saying that they pollsters couldn't reach the cell phone generation, all those people who'd given up their landlines. But turns out they must have a pretty good way of trying to figure this out, because they pretty much called it exactly. It wasn't the big landslide of 80 or 90 seats, but it was just about what was predicted.
Yeah, it is interesting, too. I'm always concerned, always have been, that these pollsters may be self-fulfilling, that people who would normally vote one way or the other will say, oh, there's either no hope or else my team is so far ahead I don't need to vote.
Well, that I think has certainly been a big criticism, and you wonder, because there's so much news the last month or so about how this was going to happen, how angry the electorate is, and did that make people angrier than they really were? And is the media really driving this because of all the publicity they give to the polls? I mean, these questions are often debated. But I think there is, when I talk to people, particularly people from outside Washington, there is an anger. And I asked someone who was a self-professed Tea Partier about a week and a half ago, where were you during the Bush years when there was a lot of spending, when Dick Cheney said deficits don't matter, just go ahead and spend? And they said, well, it's just gotten so out of hand. When you start saying $14 trillion in the national debt, it's just time to do something. And quite frankly, even during the Bush years, there were a lot of Republican voices that were unhappy about the spending. So I think, I mean, I look at it, what's happened here, it seems to be the big thing is spending. And of course, I think one of the reasons I'm here today is to talk about what this means for federal employees.
Sure.
And if there's less money to spend, some of that's going to come out of the pockets of federal employees, some of whom may lose their jobs because of restructuring, some of whom may, some of these Republicans would like to see federal pay cut.
Got an email here, and he said, just sign him Al in D.C. But he says, good morning. I've been reading your column since my arrival in D.C. in 1980. You and my coffee are my best friends in the morning. It's nice. Thank you, Al. Said, I expect the following proposals from the Republican House majority in 2011 that will impact federal workers. 1, federal pay freeze. 2, federal hiring freeze, except for defense and national security programs. 3.
And Veterans Affairs.
Okay. Cuts in education, housing, and social programs, not Social Security, of course, and the arts. Furloughs of up to 10 days. And then I think he's being facetious here. He says, shut the hot water off in federal buildings, which is what Jimmy Carter did, and wear those win buttons, whip inflation now buttons that I believe were in the Ford administration.
I think those last two are facetious.
I think so. I think he's having fun with us. What about federal pay freeze? What's the likelihood of that? And where is the pay raise now?
Oh, gosh, where is the pay raise now? The system for raising federal pay is so complicated that you pretty much need a separate PhD to fully understand it. But as I understand it, there is a pay council, salary council that met last week, and said that the pay cap between federal employees and their private sector counterparts is 24%. So supposedly that automatically goes into effect unless the president acts to come out with something different, or unless Congress overrides it through appropriations legislation. So your question is it's a pretty complex answer.
Yeah.
I've heard a number of things. I've heard a rumor, and of course, you know, Mike, you're really good at publishing various rumors and then debunking them in your columns. But I've heard a rumor that the president is going to propose a 0.9% salary increase as what he does. And, you know, and that's always different from most years, what happens is whatever the appropriations legislation says the federal pay raise is going to be. That's usually what happens. The 1.4% has been what's been in the legislation. But it hasn't gone anywhere yet. It hasn't been passed. And I think it's not likely to be passed in the lame duck session with the Republicans wanting to come in and actually have much more influence and perhaps control over the appropriations legislation in January, February, maybe even March. So I think we're likely to see continuing resolution, which I think means, you know, and again, this is very complex, but I think it means that if the president recommends a 0.9% increase, that's what would go into effect, possibly retroactively increased to 1.4% or possibly made zero if the Republicans propose that as the what goes on in the legislation. And so it could be, you know, 1.4%, 0.9, it could be zero. And, of course, Jason Chaffetz, who's going to be the new chairman of the Federal Workforce Subcommittee in the House, would actually like to see 10% cut in the federal payroll.
And one thing it won't be is what the Federal Pay Council recommends.
Oh, yeah, it never happened.
And every year and I think this year, as you said, they said the difference in federal pay in the private sector counterparts is 24%, and that's up 2%.
Which is very inconsistent with what USA Today says.
Exactly, And they are doing a lot of apples and oranges. Okay, federal hiring freeze, except for defense, national security, and as you said, veterans affairs. This is what the emailer is asking.
I don't know that they're actually what I've actually heard talk of a hard hiring freeze like the kind President Reagan put in when he first took office, but rather maybe something where for every two employees who leave, you can replace one. They're talking about maybe controlling it. And, of course, this is legislation that, you know, the dynamic of the new Congress is it's going to be proposed in the House and then filibustered in the Senate. And even if it gets through the Senate, it's going to be vetoed by the president if the president thinks it's inappropriate.
Let me ask you about furloughs, but we need to take a short break here, but we'll be right back on WFED 1500 AM. Back with Bill Bransford. He is the general counsel of the Senior Executives Association, and he's crystal balling the results of the election as it might impact federal and postal workers and retirees. And Bill, we dealt with the pay raise, which is, as you point out, is extremely complicated in the best of times, and with a lame duck session and a change in the Congress taking effect next year, even more complicated. On the table for the lame duck session is a proposal to furlough federal workers for 10 days next year. Presumably that would be one day a month for 10 months. How serious is this?
Well, I think it's very serious. Many, many local governments have done that with firefighters, police officers, teachers, and it has been a way of saving money. It's also been symbolic. That public employees are doing their share in this tough economic crisis. And that's one of the things that angered the American electorate about the government in general, that these, as they viewed it, fat cat government employees had all this job security, were getting pay raises every year. Federal employees got pay raises the last 2 years. Many, and in fact, most private sector employees did not get pay raises unless they got promotions. The last 2 years because of the crisis. And so there is a lot of anger and resentment. And I think that part of the idea of the furlough is to save money and send out the symbolic idea that federal employees are doing their share. And President Obama has not ruled out furloughs. He's publicly stated that he has not ruled out furloughs.
That's right. He said furloughs and possibly what you were talking about, maybe the not backfilling some jobs.
I think that there's a lot that's on the table, and I think you're going to see, in this Republican Congress a lot of proposals that may or may not get anywhere. But what concerns me on behalf of the federal employee community is what happened back in 1994, 95, 96, after the Republicans took, you know, very similar. This looks very much like 1994. And, you know, we had right after the Republicans came in, we had a government shutdown. And it's widely viewed that the Republicans lost that battle. President Clinton hung in there and didn't blink, and the Republicans eventually backed down. But also, President Clinton started his reinventing government. He cut way back. He decimated middle management ranks. He decimated HR and acquisitions people to say he's cutting back on government. And he won the political battle. He created a public perception that he was taking on the issue of bloated government and took that issue away from the Republicans in the 1996 election. I am concerned that the administration, you know, may take a page out of that playbook and come in with some ways of affecting federal employees. One of them could be furloughs. One of them could be pay freezes. Who knows? If we start to have cutbacks, you know, where are they going to be?
Well, you know, you mentioned that in the last 2 years, many people in the private sector didn't get pay raises. A lot of people took pay cuts.
And
that's true. I know dozens, literally dozens of people who took pay cuts ranging from 5% to 25%. Some lasted a year or more. So very serious times.
And that's when, you know, the people outside the Beltway, when they hear that kind of thing and they sense it, they get angry. Like, well, and it isn't so much that they're angry the federal employees, but they're angry with the system and the kind of runaway government that's out of control. And why can't it be a little more flexible? And if everyone else is tightening their belt, why can't the federal government, and why can't it start with its employees?
Yeah, well, and it's interesting too. The Social Security Administration, as we reported a week ago, has decided to give its employees the day off after Christmas because, as the administrator said, for a job well done.
Is it after Christmas or after Thanksgiving?
Day after Thanksgiving. I'm sorry, because Christmas is Christmas is a Saturday, but the day after. And I have not had a single federal worker ask me if they're going to get the day off. And I think in normal times, that would be the question du jour.
Well, Mike, it's really interesting because I talk to federal employees, and I think you've had people write into your column and publish some of their comments. There are many, many federal employees who would have accepted in 2009 no pay raise, in 2010 no pay raise, recognizing that the country was in an economic crisis. And I don't think there would have been a very significant backlash like, oh, we're being treated poorly because we're federal employees. I think there would have been a sense of we're being treated like everybody else. Yet that's not what happened, and it created an issue that Republicans were able to use in this past election, and a reaction, quite frankly, by Democrats, a defensive reaction. That's not helpful to federal employees as a group.
Well, you know, that's very true, and I think you're right on. And I had a lot of comments from people who said the very same thing. I'd be willing to take a pay freeze. And then people are now saying they'd rather take a pay freeze than be furloughed, in part because they want to be able to do their jobs. They don't want to be sent home one day a month. So the interesting mood out there, the feds, as we deal with them, are not the grasping bloodsuckers that they've been painted to be.
That's true, and most of them have reacted that way, and I'm not quite sure. I don't fully understand it because I know recognizing the economic situation and the newness of the Obama administration in February of 2009, I wrote a column in the Senior Executives Association's newsletter about don't expect large increases, don't expect large performance awards. I think we're entering a period of fiscal austerity. Maybe federal employee pay raises will be frozen, and it did not happen. And I was surprised because it seemed to me that the moment it was a good idea at the moment, and it would have showed the American people that they were doing something. It would have taken that issue away from Republicans to make federal employees a target.
Well, you mentioned earlier that during the Clinton years, we had divided government, but President Clinton instituted a downsizing of the government to, I think, The official number is 272,000 jobs, but more than 300,000 people. The government dropped by 300,000 people, and as you said, it decimated the middle management. They went after what they called overhead jobs.
Well, they went after
jobs.
All the non-union people, Mike. Mm-hmm. You know, the union folks were obviously politically connected with the Clinton administration, and they were immune. The workers, the frontline workers, as they were referred to at the time. They were somewhat immune from those cutbacks. So the HR people who are not in a bargaining unit, some of the acquisition people were gone, and the middle managers, including almost 10% of the senior executive service was cut back. And it's taken everyone who looks back, anyone who is familiar with government then and government now looks back on it and says, wow, what a mistake that was, because the government is still recovering from the loss of all of those jobs, and I'm concerned we're going to come into that again. And of course, with the administration being Democratic, you know, there's going to be tremendous pressure from the unions to protect those jobs. So where are cuts going to be made, if anywhere?
I want to ask you something about divided government when we come back here. Talking with Bill Bransford on WFED 1500 AM, and we'll be right back. Back with Bill Bransford. He is the general counsel of the Senior Executives Association. Bill, we were talking about divided government and what happened during the Clinton years. Got one here from, he doesn't want his name used, but he said, I think there should be a balance of power. We'll see how it works out in the long run. As far as the labor unions go, I think they fight harder when they have opposition. During the Bush years, they fought tooth and nail for our raises. During the first pay raise battle of the Obama administration, they laid down and went with whatever Congress and the president wanted, signed Love in the Balance. How about that, divided government?
Well, a lot of people are saying that, you know, that divided government works well, and a lot of people credit Bill Clinton with becoming a much better president from the point of view of having learned to govern when he learned to deal effectively with a Republican Congress in the latter part of his presidency. And that works great. And a lot of voters, I heard a lot of comments of interviews with voters that they wanted this balance. They wanted these parties going against each other. That seems to work okay in theory. And whether it works okay this time is yet to be seen, because there's a lot of anger in many of these candidates. I'm coming to Washington, I'm not backing down on my principles, and I'm cutting spending, and I'm not backing down on my principles. And there doesn't seem to be a spirit of compromise. And even as I heard Jerry Connolly's speech last night in that race that's too close to call still in the 11th District of Virginia, when he talked about reaching out across the aisle, of course, now he's in the minority, it's a lot easier to reach out across the aisle. But as he said he was going to do that, and I thought in a very sincere, good way, he also said, but I'm not going to back down from my principles. And then I heard all of these Republicans, new Republicans, Tea Partiers coming in saying, we're not going to back down from our principles. And how's that going to play out? And is it going to reach a point of gridlock? And is the gridlock going to lead to a government shutdown? And are these Tea Partiers who are going to be opposed to the president, are they going to say, we don't care what happened in 1995 when it's viewed that Newt Gingrich lost that battle with Bill Clinton? We're going to hang tough to our principles, and we're not backing down until you agree to cut spending by $100 billion. That's the proposal that's going to pass the House of Representatives in January. It's not going to go anywhere in the Senate, and the president's going to veto it, so it's probably not going to become law. But $100 billion is a lot of money. To cut government. How do you operate the government as we know it with that kind of a reduction?
It seems to me over the years, and you're much closer to the Hill than I am on a daily basis, that there's the anger level at the Hill is intense as I've ever seen it. A lot of these members really don't like each other. In the not so far good old days, they could fight during the day and then go have a drink, and their families, they went to the same soccer matches, they lived together,
sure.
The kids went to school. I don't see that now.
No, and what you have, it's even worse now than it was just in this Congress, because you have all of these conservative, moderate Democrats who lost because they were elected in conservative Republican districts. And then you have more and more moderate Republicans, like, for example, Tom Davis, who's not in Congress anymore, who are ineffective or who have been driven out rhinos. Sometimes some Republicans are called Republican in name only, and mm-hmm. it's a derogatory term. And so you have fewer and fewer moderate Republicans or Republicans who want to be seen as moderate. You have all of these blue dog Democrats who were defeated in this election. And of course, what's left are very, what they like to call themselves, progressive. Republicans like to call them liberals. But they're miles apart in their feelings about issues. And how do you get these people to come together? I think it's a different dynamic going into the 112th Congress than it was back in 1995 in the so-called Republican Revolution. And it's yet to be seen, but it could be gridlock. It could be difficult.
Yeah, I'm always interested when they talk about a government shutdown. I'm always interested in how one side manages to convince the public and the media that it was the good guy in it. Because in a sense, in a shutdown, in the Clinton shutdown of 94-95, the Congress was doing its duty and said, we want it this way. And the president was doing his duty saying, I don't like that. I'm going to veto it. I'm going to stop it. And yet the Republicans took the blame for that.
Well, they did. That's the widely viewed as the public perception. But now the public mood is a little different. One of the differences between 1995 and now is that 1995, we were not in the middle of an economic crisis. We had already recovered from a recession. And now we still have, I mean, supposedly the economists tell us we've recovered from this recession, but it doesn't feel like it. And the electorate as a whole doesn't feel that way. So how different will the dynamics be, and how will this machine that's been able to persuade the government be able to convince the electorate that it's President Obama's fault, not theirs? It'll be an interesting issue to watch unfold.
When President Reagan was elected, the Washington Post did a piece, I think it was on the front page, but it said that Washington would be decimated, and I guess they were using the Roman thing, a 10% cut in the federal population here. In fact, the government grew. It changed shape a bit. Some of the soft sides of government were eliminated, but the Defense Department built up. And everybody is assuming that if the Republicans have anything to do with it, that the government will get smaller. Do you think it will?
Well, you know, you raise such a good point of all of these prognostications that have occurred in the past of disaster, and certainly Democrats are trying to paint that kind of a picture, and I can discuss and have various scenarios in which we could almost have Armageddon and particularly for federal employees. I mean, the government could be shut down for months, and Congress could refuse to vote could back pay for it, and people could be out of all that money. And I mean, those are all very worst case scenarios. But I'm hopeful that as has happened in the past, that it finds a way to work itself out. And eventually sanity gains the moment and things work out. And I'm hopeful that it will, but I don't think it's going to be easy. And I think there's going to be a lot of rhetoric and a lot of posturing along the way. And I think some reactions from the administration. Just recently, the administration, OPM, announced a program to deal more effectively with poor performers. I can tell you right now that Chairman Darrell Issa of the Oversight and Government Reform Committee, he will be chairman in January, and he may change the name of that committee, is going to be interested in going out after that particular issue. Jason Chaffetz from Utah is going to go after that issue. And here you already have the administration kind of moving over to an issue that resonates with these Republicans. And so I think you're going to see that kind of coming together where they can. How difficult it becomes when it comes to their core principles is yet to be seen.
I'll ask you something about the civility on Capitol Hill and the new regime when we come back. We've got to take a break here on WFED 1500 AM. Hey, welcome back to the show. Glad you joined us today. I'm talking with Bill Bransford. He is the general counsel for the Senior Executive Association, and he's up on Capitol Hill all the time. And I guess you know the way the Hill works as well as anybody in town. And before the break, you mentioned that former Congressman Tom Davis, a Republican from Virginia, and had the stars aligned differently, he might well be a senator from Virginia now, but it was not to be. But he was the ranking member on the a government oversight committee. Henry Waxman was the chairman, of course. And it struck me all during this time of members of Congress openly hating each other, well beyond any partisan differences, openly hating each other, how well Waxman and Davis worked with each other and how civil they were and deferring they were to each other. Is that right?
And it's true. It's how they actually got along and worked well together. I think the best example of that for most Americans is the hearings on baseball, where they really did, where they had a common purpose, a common belief in the problem that needed to be addressed. It was very different from when Dan Burton was the chairman of that same committee. It was called Government Reform in those days, and Henry Waxman was the ranking member, where they disagreed on virtually everything. But when Tom Davis came in as chairman initially, he and Henry Waxman found a way to work together on a lot of issues. And then when the Democrats took control of the House in 2006, the same thing continued.
And that filters down to the staff, too. I know if they see the bosses making nice, genuinely right. So, they are much
well,
more
I
likely
can,
to do it themselves.
I think that's generally true.
Always.
I'm sure I know of a few exceptions here and there, but I think by and large there were efforts to cooperate and include the opposition in major discussions, major issues, that kind of thing. It did happen.
Yeah, and even when it got very nasty about the politicization of GSA, the alleged politicization of GSA, Congressman Tom Davis, a Republican, felt very strongly about it, as did Chairman Waxman, the Democrat, on the other side. And yet they deferred to each other. They seemed to they listened to each other's arguments. They permitted witnesses to be called, and I thought that was not only unusual, but especially given the current mood of Congress.
And there's been a relationship like that in the Senate between Senator Voinovich and Senator Akaka, Senator Akaka being the chairman now of the Oversight of Government Management Subcommittee, which is the subcommittee for federal employee issues, and Senator Voinovich, who's unfortunately leaving as he didn't run for reelection. And that kind of bipartisan spirit worked even more effectively, it was more visible in the Senate than I think it ever had been in the House. And it's really sad to see Senator Voinovich leaving. And I hope whoever replaces him as ranking member, since the Republicans or the Democrats rather are keeping the Senate, whoever replaces him will be able to develop that same kind of bipartisan spirit. Because I think federal employee issues should be nonpartisan. They should be free from the partisan bickering. It has been that way in the Senate. It's been a pleasure to deal with both of those offices.
It's interesting you'd say that, because we got one here, and I didn't get his permission to use his name. But what did he say here? So I'm not going to mention his agency, but he said, "I'm a non-union employee in a very heavily unionized agency. I do not belong to the union, not because I'm too busy, too cheap, or afraid of the union," as I said in today's column, but he said, "it's because I strongly disagree with what's in it for me, liberal philosophy, and their politics of division. I did not ask for their representation, nor do I want it. The taxpayer be damned. What's best for the country is a long-forgotten afterthought." And he's saying that he doesn't like to belong to a federal union because it's too partisan.
Well, there was a column in the Washington Post last week about the unions and how they, many of them gave to Democratic candidates. They gave to both, but they gave even more so to Democrats. And I know that there were a number of the federal employee union officials and members who were out campaigning for Democrats. It's interesting because the reaction that we had in the community of government management associations that I'm rather close to is that, you know, the managers and executives try to stay very, very much nonpartisan and have not backed particular candidates, but rather have supported incumbents who care about federal employee issues. So there is a perception that they're, you know, if you're in a union, you're supposed to back the Democrat. I think that's the public perception. And I don't think every union member feels that way. And certainly every union would say that their members are free to vote however they want, but there is some sentiment like that, and there always has been. There's, when you look in the private sector, there's all kinds of court cases that talk about how much of my union dues can you spend to support a political program. So there's a lot of people that feel like the person who wrote that email. And what's interesting is that I heard Tom Davis on television last night as a commentator on the news talking about Daryl Issa, the new chairman of Oversight and Government Reform, who likes federal employees. And I know that he does because I've heard him say that. And he likes federal employees, but he doesn't really particularly care for federal employee unions. So it's going to be interesting to see how the unions are received by the Republicans who deal with federal employee issues and how effective they will be in getting their message across. I have met with people on those staffs and have talked about the agenda for the Senior Executives Association. And, you know, we've worked with them, and I look forward to working with them in the new Congress. But I can tell you the fundamental difference between the old Democratic Congress and the new Congress for federal managers is that the new leadership is going to be much more interested in giving managers the tools they need to help make the federal workforce accountable. And they're also going to be interested in making sure that managers enforce that accountability. There's a lot of, you know, for example, Jason Chaffetz really wanted all the federal employees who don't pay their income taxes fired. That was an issue that he raised before. So that kind of thing, where if you mess up as a federal employee, you lose your job. If you're a poor performer, you make it easier to get rid of them. There's a possibly longer probationary periods as a proposal before you get appeal rights to the Merit Systems Protection Board. Things like that I think are possibly going to be discussed by the new Congress.
Yeah, and do you think the administration will go along with that, will sort of hop on the bandwagon? It's hard, depending on how you couch it, how you phrase it, but it's hard to say, I want to protect the jobs of government workers who are poor performers. That's a non-starter.
There was a comment by an OPM executive last week, I think it was published, about how they're working with the unions to try to come up with a way to simplify the firing of poor performers. And and this is something the Senior Executives Association and other management groups have been a battle we've been fighting for years. And quite frankly, it's like you get a very polite response and then it never goes anywhere. So it's been amazing to me that now, after all this time, I mean, Jimmy Carter cared about this issue, Reagan cared about this issue, but people have been silent on this. It's sort of like every manager for him or herself. And they go after the problem employee. When the problem employee files an EEO complaint, then all of a sudden higher level management, particularly political management, if they don't like the publicity that may come from this EEO complaint, well, the frontline manager that's under scrutiny all of a sudden becomes the problem. And that causes other managers to back off. It's become, more than a small problem in the federal workforce. And the bigger issue, of course, is the public perception. So finding a way to create the impression, the perception in the public that, yes, managers are going after poor performers. They are making those tough decisions. They are holding employees accountable. I think that's what this new Congress, one of the things they'd like to see. And, of course, the unions, while they can't defend the poor performer, they do get a lot of their membership by saying that if you get in trouble, we'll take your case to arbitration, we'll represent you, we'll stand behind you. So they like to make the process as simple as it can be in favor of the employee so that they can prevail more often, so that they can say, see, look what a great job we did. So I think there's going to be a battle there.
One of the arguments in government is that the government probation period is so long that it enables them to weed out the bad people. But I want to ask you about that when we come back here. We're going to need to take a break. Talking with Phil Bransford, General Counsel of the Senior Executives Association. We'll be right back here on 1500 AM. Okay, back, and thank you for being with us. Hope you will remember the show. These shows are archived on our webpage, so you can listen anytime, and you can alert a friend and have them listen at their leisure, at their convenience. Bill, we were talking about the poor performer thing, and as you said, this was an issue under President Jimmy Carter, and it fizzled. It was an issue under President Ronald Reagan, and it fizzled. And you think the poor performer thing is coming back?
Well, I've had discussions with John Barry, the director of OPM, who said, as part of his overall efforts to reform government, that he was going to make dealing with poor performer more effectively a central part of that. And of course, that whole issue of civil service reform has fizzled because, number one, it's too expensive You know, if you're going to actually pay people what they deserve and reward your best performers what they should receive, it costs too much money. So it fizzled for that reason. And also the unions were quite concerned about a civil service reform that would have meant abolishing or substantially modifying the general schedule system. So there was a lot of opposition by the union. So this effort to reform the civil service has somewhat stalled, if not perhaps stopped. But a major part of that was going after the poor performer and emphasizing that. And now that you know, the meetings I've had with the people on the Republican side who deal or will be dealing with federal employee issues, that's a major concern that they have and a major issue. And I see OPM making public statements that seem to be moving toward that and seem to be consistent with some of the things John Barry said when he first became OPM director. So, yeah, I think that's going to be part of the future.
Well, one of the things, particularly when you talk about the unions, and they were very political. They even got into the D.C. Mayor's race. They endorsed a candidate. One of them, AFGE, endorsed a candidate. And that's a bit unusual, but it just shows they wanted to I guess, show their clout. And as they were successful, too, Vince Gray won it. But when you have as far as the unions are concerned, a pro-union administration, Democrat President Obama, and you have a pro-union or pro-Fed, at least Senate and what, and then you have John Barry, who is, I guess, the quintessential perfect OPM director. He grew up in this area. He grew up in the government. He studied it.
He worked on the Hill for many years.
He knows how Congress works. He worked at the National Zoo, straightened that out. And I would have thought that just about anything, and President Obama has taken him to at least two cabinet meetings that I know of, which is most unusual, and said to the cabinet, he said, if this guy wants something, give it to him. And I would think if somebody like John Barry says, we've got to reform this system, that it's probably going to go somewhere.
Well, and it might do it. It might happen in pieces. And I think John's original vision, and I personally agree with him on it, is to do a comprehensive reform of the whole system. But it might go in pieces, and he may very well work with the Republican Congress to do it, and he may not. I'm just sort of trying to prognosticate based on what I see out there. But I think there's going to have to be. As I say this, I'm thinking of counterarguments. I think there's going to have to be some issues where the administration works with the new House of Representatives on the one hand. On the other hand, the Republicans in Congress were very effective in just saying no the last 2 years. They just said no to President Obama on everything. They didn't work with him on anything. And it resonated with the American people. And what concerns me is that kind of resonating with the American people by just staying there and stubbornly saying no, or resolutely saying no, depending on your perspective. How will that carry over to taking it to the point of having a government shutdown, which I don't think's in the works, but it happened before. And if it happens again, will there be a calculation that this time they can sway American public opinion that the Republicans have the right answer because the administration's spending too much?
Well, the interesting thing in past shutdowns has been that even an extended one, no federal worker lost a penny. They all got paid.
They all got back pay.
In effect, they got paid. It didn't last long enough that they even missed some money.
But last year there was a problem with some funding legislation at the Department of Transportation, and there were a group of workers over there, not the whole department, but a group of workers within the department who were put out of work for a short time. And there was a real battle in the Senate to give those employees back pay. They finally got it. But there was a group of Republican senators who were blocking the passage of that legislation. And so I see this kind of growing sentiment for this federal employees take it for granted. Well, if we're off for the snow or government shutdown or whatever, we're always going to get our pay. I don't know that things may change. I mean, I don't think they will, but they could.
I thought the reason that there was a fight was because it was a small group and you could sort of zero.
Oh, it's yeah, like it was the, a small, right. You couldn't
like a child them. Lost in the woods. But if you're talking about not paying 1.4 million people for 6 days, then it becomes
a tougher issue, right?
Yeah. Okay. Now, you mentioned Congressman Daryl Issa, and he, I guess he's well known to federal workers because he's made a lot of statements and whatnot that seem anti-Fed. But you say the congressman or former Congressman Davis said he likes government workers.
Yes.
What does he not like about the government?
Well, he thinks the government spends too much money. He thinks it's too big. He needs to be reined in. And the other thing that I think you'll see Congressman Issa do when he takes over the chairmanship is to issue a lot of subpoenas. He's going to go after programs. He's going to go after issues, particularly those where he thinks he can show that the administration has done something that the American people would not like. There is a story that appeared on a Saturday on the front page of the Washington Post. I think it may have been there on a Saturday for a reason. I don't know. It's a story that's been on Fox News over the last couple of years. It has to do with the decision early on in the Obama administration to drop a voting rights prosecution involving the new Black Panther Party. And I think it was in Philadelphia. And there was a prosecution that some new Black Panther Party members dressed in military garb and carrying a nightstick were standing in front of a polling place, and there was a video of this. So the question was, is that a voter intimidation, or could it be viewed as voter intimidation, and was that subject to a prosecution? And there was actually a decision made to prosecute, and then when the Obama administration people came in, the political appointees, they decided to drop it over the objections of the career attorneys, and it's made quite a bit of news. Again, in the Fox News and in the conservative media, the Washington Times writes about it. But finally, made the front page of the Washington Post, and I was just pondering, well, is this an issue that Chairman Issa would use his subpoena power for to have hearings on? And is it an issue that has legs? Because I can tell you that there have been Republican members of Congress who have already been upset about the issue, who've tried to make noise, and they've had little publicity. It hasn't really resonated with the public, but might it resonate outside the Beltway if there's a greater spotlight that is shined on it? And there are many, many other issues like this that you're going to see Chairman Issa issue subpoenas on, hold hearings, do investigations. And I think this is going to affect all of those federal employees, the career federal employees that work in and around those issues. They're going to find it a major part of their job to respond to him.
The ancient curse is, may you live in interesting times, and we certainly do that. Thank you, Bill Bransford, for being with us today.
Thank you, Mike, for having me.
On Federal News Radio. And we'll be back here next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Remember, the show is archived, so you can listen anytime. Have a good week. See you next Wednesday at 10.